All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives there in MP3 format for you. To download, feel free to burn copies and give them away to your friends if that's what you like. I get that email at least a couple times a week saying, is it okay if I give these away? Please do. Download and burn and give away to your heart's delight. Also, I write for antiwar.com, and I'm an editorial assistant there. My next guest also writes for antiwar.com. His name is Gordon Prather. He writes for WorldNet Daily as well. He's a nuclear physicist, formerly of the Lawrence Livermore and Sandia National Laboratories. He's the man who coined the term bonkers Bolton. And if facts had anything to do with United States foreign policy, this man could stop the next war. Welcome back to the show, Gordon Prather.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be back on your show.
It's always great to have you on, Gordon. Now, please tell us a little bit more about your background, because there's a lot more to your resume than just used to work at Sandia National Laboratories. Why don't you give us a little bit of background so people know that you know what you're talking about?
Well, the Navy put me in the nuclear weapons business when I was commissioned, graduated from college and commissioned. And I was in it basically for the next 20 years at various locations and places. I was a bomb tester at the Lawrence Livermore Lab, as it was then called, and then I was a technical director for underground nuclear tests at Sandia National Laboratories. I did my PhD dissertation research at the Idaho National Engineering and Environmental Lab, as it's now called. It wasn't called that then. I worked as a legislative assistant for Henry Bellman, senator from Oklahoma, during the Carter years. I was a Reagan political appointee in the Pentagon. I was chief scientist for the Army, and I had a couple of other jobs while I was there. I've long been associated with Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico and have been intimately involved in the programs that he sponsored, promoted, originated to prevent Russian, Soviet nuclear weapons and fissile materials from proliferating. And I'm now essentially retired, and I'm back in New Mexico again. And I write these columns, as you say, and talk to you on the phone from time to time.
Well, and so the point here really is that you're not just experienced in the scientific details of atomic weapons, but you also understand a little bit about the politics of nuclear weapons and how the various nation states relate to each other on the topic of nuclear weapons, too.
Yeah, well, to a certain extent, I'm more nearly aware of the entire life cycle of a nuclear weapon, from concept through disposition of the fissile material from a disarmed or dismantled nuclear weapon. I have, in association with these programs of Senator Domenici's, I have been to Ukraine. But I've not actually been to Russia. No, I've been to Hong Kong, but I've never been to mainland China. I've been many times to what's now called Taiwan. I was there when it was called Formosa. Been many times to Japan. I've never been to Korea. Okay, that's about it as far as foreign policy is concerned.
Right. Okay. Well, and I know from reading your columns that you have a very sharp eye on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and how the United States relates to these organizations and treaties, and how it perceives their application to the rogue states of Iran and North Korea. And that's mostly what I want to talk about with you today, Mr. Prather. So if you can just hang right there on the line, we'll be right back after this short break for a long segment with Gordon Prather, all about the IAEA and the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Stay tuned. It's the Weekend Interview Show. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott, and I'm talking with Gordon Prather. You can look up his archives at antiwar.com or at worldnetdaily.com. He's a nuclear physicist, and he knows all about nuclear bombs and how they work and how the international treaties apply to them. Let's start, Gordon, with your article that's up on antiwar.com today. Bronx cheers for the nuke panel.
Yeah, thank you.
You say in this article that the recent Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, the Blue Ribbon Panel that was created by Bush to explain what went wrong with the intelligence, you say that they didn't even mention the International Atomic Energy Agency in their report. Why should they have?
I don't think I said exactly that. If you don't mind, Daphna Linzer, who is a writer for the Washington Post on these kind of subjects, began her analysis last week of this report by the commission in the following manner. And I need to read these first two paragraphs to set the stage. Here's what she says. Of all the claims U.S. intelligence made about Iraq's arsenal in the fall and winter of 2002, it was a handful of new charges that seemed the most significant. Secret purchases of uranium from Africa, biological weapons being made in mobile laboratories, and pilotless planes that could disperse anthrax or sarin gas into the air above U.S. cities. Second paragraph. By the time President Bush ordered U.S. troops to disarm Saddam Hussein of the deadly weapons he was allegedly trying to build, every piece of fresh evidence had been tested and disproved by U.N. inspectors, according to a report commissioned by the president and released Thursday. That would have been last Thursday. Okay, now let me accent the second paragraph by putting that last clause first, okay? According to a report commissioned by the president and released Thursday, by the time President Bush ordered U.S. troops to disarm Saddam Hussein of the deadly weapons he was allegedly trying to build, every piece of fresh evidence had been tested and disproved by U.N. inspectors. Okay, that's the Washington Post. That's a prestigious outfit. And her story, I assume Daphna is a female, Linzer's story has been picked up in the Chinese press and the Indian press and the Pakistani press. All over the world, people are now of the opinion that that commission report showed that everything that Colin Powell essentially said before the UN, UN Security Council in January of 2003, just weeks before the invasion, had been checked upon and disproved by UN inspectors. Now, that's the end of that harangue. Now, I read, I think, all of that report. It's like 1,000 pages, the commission's report. And maybe it's in there somewhere, but I can't find it, what she says that it did. And the point is, maybe I'm incompetent, maybe I can't find it, but the point is I shouldn't have been able to have missed it. That should have been the most important thing that that commission found. Was that the charges that Colin Powell made before the U.N. Security Council had already been checked out by U.N. inspectors, already, by that time, and disproved. Now, that's the point of the column that I have today, is that, first of all, the commission didn't find that, okay? But if it had, that ought to be the headline all around the world. And it shouldn't matter whether or not the intelligence gathering was flawed or not. It shouldn't matter whether or not Vice President Cheney went in and influenced what the intelligence analysts were reporting. The point is that by the time Colin Powell made those charges before the Security Council, even if the commission didn't say it, the UN inspectors had investigated every one of those charges and disproved them. Okay, and that's the end of that harangue. Now, the point of all this is, if the commission had done its job, then a recommendation that they should have made but did not, it is in the future, any intelligence estimate, national intelligence estimate, for some place like Iran, ought to take into due consideration the findings of the UN inspectors on the ground, who have for almost 2 years now, in the case of Iran, been able to go anywhere they wanted to go and see anything they had any reasonable expectation that there might be something there that they ought to see. And they report this over and over and over again. The most recent report of this was in February of this year. Those reports were made, and yet we still have administration officials saying that their intelligence is that Iran has a secret nuclear weapons development program somewhere in Iran. They don't know where it is.
Basically, they're just ignoring. They're just deliberately pretending the IAEA doesn't exist and that they've never heard of Al-Baradei or any of his reports.
That's right. They're just totally ignoring it. And as I say, if the commission had done its job, it would have said, based upon what happened in Iraq, don't ever ignore those people ever again, because they were absolutely right.
Well, if you can't find that part in the report that the Washington Post reporter is quoting, is that because maybe she has a classified version and you don't?
It's conceivable, but I don't think that's the case, and I don't want to. I've never met her. I don't know her. I've written a couple of emails to influential people at the Washington Post, asking them, "Tell me, where did she get that? Where in the report does it say what she said it said?" You know. And my point is not that she's a lousy reporter. My point is, the commission's report should have said that. It should have been a principal finding. It should have been a recommendation that never again should our intelligence community totally ignore the findings several hundred inspectors that are on the ground that have been searching that country for almost 2 years now.
Okay, now I'm sorry to do this to you, Gordon, because I ask you this every time.
I know.
Got to get this clear. You're not some UN-loving pink Okami, are you, Gordon?
There you go. I'm not. I absolutely am not.
Okay, so what do you care if our intelligence agencies pay attention to what the UN says or not?
Yeah, that's right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the so-called NPT Treaty.
Okay, go ahead.
That's basically our treaty. It went into force in 1970, I believe. Negotiated in 1968, went into force in 1970. There already existed, as a result of the Adams for Peace program by President Eisenhower back in the 50s, a UN organization called the International Atomic Energy Agency. Its function, as it originally was set up, was to assist in the transition or transferal of nuclear energy for medicinal purposes, for energy power and all that sort of thing, to countries that didn't already have it. And they were specifically supposed to help provide the benefits of nuclear energy to developing and third world countries. Okay. Now, 20 years later, after they were had been in the business all that time, and they also provided help to these countries that were getting such things as medical isotopes, you know, for use in cancer research and cancer treatment, they would provide them guidelines on how to safely store it and all that kind of stuff. Okay, the treaty, our treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in Article, let's see, what is it? Article 3 of the treaty says that each signatory to the treaty that doesn't already have nuclear weapons, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're called non-nuclear weapon states. Each state that doesn't already have nuclear weapons that signs that treaty undertakes to accept safeguards as set forth in an agreement to be negotiated and concluded with the International Atomic Energy Agency in accordance with the statute of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Okay. I'm with you so far, Gordon.
Okay. And it's for the exclusive purpose, this safeguards agreement, exclusive purpose of verification of the fulfillment of its obligations assumed under this treaty, with a view to preventing diversion of nuclear energy from peaceful uses to nuclear weapons. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we got two. We got the safeguards agreement that all these states that don't have nuclear weapons agree to sign. And they've got two problems. They've got two things. They are obligated, once they have signed it, to live up to it. That is, to if it says that, if the safeguards agreement says that a medical source is in a building, building A, and they move it to building B, and they don't tell the IAEA that they've done that, then they fail to properly comply with all the obligations under the treaty through the safeguards agreement.
Okay, hold it right there, Gordon.
That's not a violation of the non-proliferation treaty.
Oh, I see. That would just be a violation of the safeguards agreement, but not of the treaty itself. Okay, hang on right there. It's Gordon Prather. He writes for AntiWar.com. He knows all about nukes and the IAEA, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gordon Prather. He writes for AntiWar.com and for WorldNet Daily. He's got one up on AntiWar.com today called Bronx Cheers for the Nuke Panel. And we're talking about the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is not altogether simple. So far, I think Gordon has explained that in 1970 they created this Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that each country then has their own specific safeguards agreements, safeguard agreements that they come up with, that they sign with the International Atomic Energy Agency. And now, best I understand, Iran, I think, has an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Gordon, what does that mean?
Well, if you don't mind, let me finish what would be a violation. As I said...
Oh, right, the violation.
If,
right.
If Iran, for example, had a cobalt-60 gamma source for medical research or treatment of cancer, and it was in Building A, and they moved that to Building B, and they didn't inform the International Atomic Energy Agency that they had done that, then they would be not in compliance with their safeguards agreement, not in full compliance with their safeguards agreement. They're required to do that sort of thing. But that's not a violation of the treaty. What's a violation of the treaty for Iran would be the diversion of special nuclear materials, let's say highly enriched uranium, from a peaceful purpose such as fuel for a reactor to the production of a nuclear weapon. That is a violation of the treaty. Now, the point is, starting way back in the Clinton administration, maybe it goes back even further than that, people in the administration, and it's gotten really, really, I don't know, the Bush administration is really doing a lot of this. They have tried to get everyone to believe that failure to completely comply with a safeguards agreement is tantamount to a violation of the treaty itself, and therefore we ought to get to go in and bomb them, you know?
Right. Well, so, Gordon, you're telling me that nowhere in the treaty does it say that, hey, to violate your safeguards agreement is to violate this treaty.
Oh, it's just the other way around. It's
okay.
Over and over again. If you go and look to see... If you have to go read the IAEA statute. Remember I said that Iran has signed an agreement. We'll get to the additional protocol in just a minute.
Okay.
Has agreed to accept safeguards as set forth in an agreement to be negotiated and concluded with the IAEA in accordance with the statute of that International Atomic Energy Agency. Now, that statute existed long before the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So what you have to do is go read that, and I don't know whether anybody in our State Department has ever gone and read it, but I've read it, and it makes it very clear that a failure to completely comply with the safeguards agreement in no way, shape, or form constitutes a violation of the treaty. You know? You've got to actually... It's largely a matter of intent, but you've actually got to be deliberately setting out to develop nuclear weapons. Then, if you've got something that is that you're in non-compliance with the safeguards agreement, like you took a whole bunch of highly enriched uranium that was intended to be reactor fuel, moved it to a secret location, further enriched it, and made weapons-grade highly enriched uranium, then you're in violation of the treaty because you're trying to make a nuclear weapon.
And what our government is doing is they're trying to conflate all these definitions
together because
they want to attack Iran.
That Iran has been in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty in the past, and the IAEA has made it very clear that they can find no evidence whatsoever that Iran has ever attempted to develop nuclear weapons.
And that's why the administration is currently doing everything they can to unseat Mohammed al-Baradei from the IAEA.
That's right.
Because he's doing his job.
Just like happened in Iraq, where they went in there and they rained on the parade. Now, I'd like to go on to this review conference for the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which comes up next month in New York City.
Right, that's the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference.
Yeah, they just every 5 years they're supposed to get together and sort of get progress reports on what's happened since the last time that they met, what progress has been made under the treaty to rid the world of nuclear weapons and all that sort of thing. Well, according to an official, what would you call it, op-ed piece, I guess, which is posted at the State Department's website, our representative to that review conference, whose name is Jackie Sanders, and I believe she's a woman, not that it matters, but you never know when somebody's name is Jackie whether they're female or not, and I've never met her. But in any case, in her piece that's there on the website, which you can go read, it's called How to Strengthen the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's the title of her piece.
Of course.
If you read it, it's relatively obvious, at least to me, that we, the United States, intend to make certain demands at that conference, that the treaty be extensively amended.
Or
and
else.
That if they don't go along with the rest of them, the rest of the world does not go along with our amendments, does not adopt them, which I suspect they will not, because for an amendment to be made to that treaty,
quick,
not only the majority of the signatories, and there are about 190 of them, have to go along with it, the majority.
All right, hang on, Gordon, we'll be right back. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and we're talking atom bombs with Gordon Prather. That and the Non-Proliferation Treaty. You should know today is the second anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, and as we speak, effigies of George Bush and Tony Blair are being toppled in the town square in downtown Baghdad. Okay, now, Gordon, we're talking about this upcoming Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, and how this woman, Jackie Sanders, you say, you fear she's going to walk in with a list of demands so great that the rest of the world won't be able to go along?
Yeah, well, I don't know if the rest of the world will, but as the Non-Proliferation Treaty is structured, in order to have the treaty amended, it essentially provides Russia and China and France and with a veto authority, that is, even if they get the majority, the amendment will not take place unless those three weapon states agree. Okay, now, as I say, she's not just a woman. Her official title is, she is U.S. representative to the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva, and she's also, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Disarmament and non-proliferation are very different things, and we'll talk about that some other time, perhaps, if you like. But let me get back to what it says here in her op-ed piece, which is official. It's on a U.S. State Department website. And this is how she says one of the things that we're going to do to, quote, unquote, to amend the nonproliferation treaty so as to strengthen it, okay? What she's all upset about is this, the distinction between violation of the treaty itself and just failure to fully comply with the safeguards agreement, which I said you'd be failing to be in full compliance with your safeguards agreement if you removed the cobalt 60 source from one building to another and you didn't tell the IAEA about it. Okay, here's what she says. Effective enforcement of the nonproliferation treaty also requires a close examination of what constitutes a violation. It makes no sense to wait until a non-nuclear weapon state has secretly assembled a nuclear weapon before taking action. Facts indicating that the purpose of a particular activity was the acquisition of a nuclear explosive device would tend to show noncompliance. Example of such facts include clandestine facilities or procurement, willful IAEA safeguards violations, and this one, get this one, and a nuclear program with no legitimate justification for peaceful purposes.
Uh-huh.
Now, we're claiming loudly that their uranium enrichment program,
they being Iran,
that there can be no legitimate justification for that because they got all this oil.
Right. Well, what is the legitimate justification? They do, after all, Gordon, have a ton of oil under Persia.
Well, so what? I mean, they got zillions of barrels of oil, but, you know, that's not the point. The point is that as the treaty now stands, they have an absolute inalienable right, and that's what it says in it, inalienable right to have a uranium enrichment program or to have nuclear power reactors. So long as those activities are subject to an IAEA safeguards agreement. That's what it says. They have an inalienable right. And so what we've got, it's hard to believe, but we've got Iran standing up for the nonproliferation treaty and the United States trying to tear it apart. It's just the weirdest thing imaginable. And it's all because, in my view, hasn't got anything to do with nuclear weapons. Hasn't got anything to do with that. It may have a lot to do with oil. I don't know.
Pretext.
Huh?
Pretext.
Yeah, right.
Just
well,
like in Iraq.
I'm sort of outraged out. But you know, it's just, here's what I predict will happen. First of all, in a secret meeting, we're going to try to get rid of El Baradei before this. He's the director general right now, and he's been a thorn in their side, in our side, I should say. I'm on our side. And I just can't believe that we want to make Israel safe from Iranian aggression so much that we're willing to tear up the nonproliferation treaty and whatever else we have to do, look the other way while they bomb Iraq reactors that are Russian reactors with Russian personnel in them, with Russian fuel.
Who cares about all these consequences? Don't you know Jesus is coming back soon?
There was a program on television that I sat and watched the other night. I just couldn't believe it. It was all about rapture and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, hell, we might as well just, burn up all the oil and cut down all the trees and go ahead and start a nuclear war with Russia because, you know, all the sooner to go to heaven.
Yeah, maybe that's one of the four horses of the apocalypse. I don't know. Beats me.
Is Russia so invested in Iran that they would have to get involved if we go to war, or are they going to be able to sit this out?
I don't know what would happen. I hope that let me give you a scenario that I hope doesn't happen. That we or the Israelis or some mysterious outfit bombs the Bushehr reactor, which is Russian built, has Russian personnel, is safeguarded, has IAEA personnel there. The fuel belongs to the reactor fuel belongs to the Russians, and they're going to take it back and reprocess it and all that sort of thing. Plus the uranium enrichment facility, which has nothing in it yet. It's a building, an underground building or bunker, whatever you want to call it, that will eventually be capable of housing 50,000 gas centrifuges. But at the moment, it has nothing in it. They don't have a uranium enrichment program.
Well, and you've made this point before, at least in your articles, I think, on the show as well, that even if they're enriching uranium, that's not necessarily just to make a bomb out of.
Well, absolutely not. And they're doing it. They are. All of those facilities are subject to the IA safeguards regime. That doesn't mean somebody comes around every year or so to check to see if the seals are broken or something like that. They have environmental monitoring stuff in there. The kind of stuff that we pioneered for U.S. and Soviet missile destruction. You have cameras that feed up through satellite and go back down to Geneva, which is where, not Geneva, to Vienna, which is where the IAEA is. They can sit there and they can watch what these guys are doing in the reactor.
So they don't even need to inspect once a year, because if somebody broke a seal, they would know anyway.
They inspect every time they think they need to. Okay, so here are all these facilities. I'm afraid that somebody may decide we have to take them out. We don't. They're not doing anything wrong. They're perfectly subject to the IAEA safeguards. Okay. I hope we don't use nuclear weapons. Okay, what will happen then, I'm afraid of, this is the scenario, is that the Iranians, who have lots of supersonic sea-skimming anti-ship missiles, which they got from the Chinese and I think maybe some from the Russians, they're going to shut down the Persian Gulf because there's a choke point there. And it's not called the Persian Gulf for nothing. You know, Iran is Persia. It's their Gulf. And there's a place that's only, I don't know how wide it is, maybe 30 or 40 miles wide there at the mouth of the Gulf. They can shut that down anytime they want to. They can sink any ship, and almost any ship. I would get, even our warships that try to go through there. But any tanker, that's it. So they'll shut down the Persian Gulf. We won't have any Iranian oil. We won't have any Iraqi oil. We won't have any Saudi Arabian oil. And guess, you know, what'll happen next? I don't know.
We'd have to go for full-fledged invasion and take the country over at that
point.
Well,
we don't have the invasion forces. So the next thing to do, I guess, would be to threaten Tehran with nuclear weapons. I don't know what other thing we could do. We haven't got the troops to go invading a country like Iran.
Gordon, I read an article a few months back on Newsweek, MSNBC Newsweek. You know, they share a space on the web there, I guess.
Yeah.
And they had this article called Wargaming the Mullahs. And it said that the Army brass and the Air Force, you know, the generals, they went and did their war games. And that how they came back to the Pentagon appointees and said, forget it. We can't attack Iran. There's no way to make a single aggressive move toward Iran that would not escalate throughout Asia. And so we cannot do it. Your answer is no. And, you know, I guess we have to put trust in the goodwill of the civilians at the Pentagon.
Well, I hope they also involve the U.S. Navy in those war games, because that's what I think will happen.
Right. Oh, I'm sure they did. And apparently the answer was, listen, if you do this, you're throwing this entire region into total instability. Musharraf in Pakistan is one bullet away from a coup d'etat. They've already tried to kill him three or four times, I think.
More than six. I think it's about eight now.
Eight
official attempts so far on his life.
And we have India and Pakistan, both nuclear-armed countries there. We have China and Russia, both with tremendous interests in that part of Asia. This really could, if we just let George Bush run everything, this could end up being, you know, the end of the world style Armageddon kind of thing, like the Born Agains want.
Yeah, well, it doesn't look good. I personally hope that cooler heads prevail, but I don't know. A lot of us thought, well, surely, after the UN inspectors had demonstrated that Saddam Hussein had in fact disarmed from essentially in 1991,
right,
and had made no attempt since then to reconstitute his so-called weapons of mass destruction capabilities. That was demonstrated in January and in February and in early March of 2003.
Thought that might have stopped
them. You know, we were so close. We already had troops, probably special forces, in Iraq even then, even as these as Colin Powell was making his speech. I don't know, but in any case, I guess he just couldn't stop that war. Well, this one is a lot easier to stop because we're not going to invade Iran. We haven't got the troops to do it. So it's going to have to be some kind of bombing, some kind of strikes or something of that nature. And I just think that the immediate result is going to be the Persian Gulf gets shut down. No oil from the Persian Gulf to anybody except maybe Russia and China. Of course, Russia doesn't need oil, but China does. They need it badly. And they're not going to be very happy about that.
I'd hate to see, I do hate to see politicians messing around with situations with countries that frankly have thousands of nuclear weapons. I mean, I guess China probably has tens of them, but Russia has thousands of hydrogen bombs.
Well, worse than that, they've got ICBMs that these things are on. And not only that, but a lot of them are now mobile. There's no way. See, the whole business of mutually assured destruction, originally what we were trying to do was to knock out their missile silos, the ICBMs that were in hardened missile silos against nuclear attack. That's one of the reasons that the nuclear weapons that we have on our ICBMs are relatively low yield. Because we were going to essentially put one on a silo, what it amounted to, because they were, you know, they'd be spread out on a missile field. Those things are not, but if they're mobile, and many of the Russian ICBMs now are, you don't know where they are. So that means then the only thing that you can do with your nuclear weapons is to kill civilians. Because, you know, you don't know where the missiles are that your missiles were designed to take out. And so your only option is to take out Moscow, basically.
And it's too bad everybody can't just play nice.
Well, it would be a lot simpler if we didn't have this burr under our saddle about bringing democracy to the Middle East.
or even if we put down all the window dressing and just say even securing, quote unquote, all that oil. And that's not really necessary. I mean, they're going to sell the oil to us if we're not occupying the land. They still have to sell it to make any money.
Oh, yeah. The war in Iraq, which is, I don't think the Iraqi oil production is even yet up to what it was under Saddam, much less to the levels that they hoped it would be. It's been wonderful for Russia because, you know, they got a lot of oil.
Hey, it's been really good for ExxonMobil, too.
Well, I guess. They don't care, you know.
Hey, let me ask you this, Gordon.
All the national companies really are multinational. If you don't know that, Scott, you ought to go sit in on their board meetings or something sometime.
Oh, I'm sure they'll let me right in.
Well, they might.
Hey, I have my list of nuclear-armed countries here. Let me know if I left anybody off the list. The United States, Russia, China, the United Kingdom, France, India, Pakistan, and Israel.
Yeah, Israel has never ever admitted that they have nuclear weapons because I think I can't give you chapter and verse, but there's some kind of statement or declaration that our president has to make to Congress before we can provide them any aid, and we provide them billions of dollars in aid every year.
So that means that George Bush is a criminal breaking the law.
No one's ever told George Bush that Israel has nuclear weapons.
Ignorance of the law is no excuse.
Well, the president has to tell Congress that, so far as he knows, Israel doesn't have is not in violation of this or that, you know.
Right, and isn't it funny how any 10-year-old kid in America knows that Israel has nukes, but that doesn't necessarily include the president of the United
don't
States.
Don't ask, don't tell.
He's only 9.
Isn't
great,
that weird?
Great. Everybody, in case you're just tuning in and wondering what the heck is going on here, I'm Scott Horton, and this is the Weekend Interview Show. My guest is Gordon Prather. He's a nuclear physicist, and he writes a heck of a great column for antiwar.com and for WorldNet Daily. And honestly, nonproliferation treaties and safeguards agreements and additional protocols can be quite confusing. But I highly recommend Gordon Prather's articles to you. If you go through his archives at antiwar.com and read through a few it'll begin to make itself pretty clear what's going on. It's basically the same script that they used against Iran. He's, you know, I remember George Bush said he's 15 minutes from a weapon.
Yeah.
And they're basically playing that same script. Now, how do you think that the nomination of John Bolton to be ambassador to the UN fits into this script there, Gordon? Oh, okay, I'm sorry I asked you that. I shouldn't have. I'll ask you that when we get back from this break.
Okay.
Coming up. It's the Weekend Interview Show. It's the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm Scott. He's Gordon Prather. And we'll be right back. Friends, I'm Scott Horton, and we're wrapping up the Weekend Interview Show, talking with Gordon Prather. He's a nuclear physicist, formerly from the Lawrence Livermore Laboratories and the Sandia National Laboratories. He writes for WorldNet Daily and for antiwar.com. And, by the way, my website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives in MP3 format for you there to download. And my email, Scott@weekendinterviewshow.com or Scott@antiwar.com if you'd like to comment on the show. And now I just want to say this real quick so I don't forget before the end of the show. Maybe you can remember too, but I have two more questions for you. First of all, Bolton's role in playing this exact Iraq script against Iran. And also, if very briefly, if you can rehearse for us the story of Iran's golden offer to internationalize their atomic program.
Okay, Scott, I'll try to do that. You're correct. There are three or four branch points or key points in time that are coming up. The first one is whether or not we're successful in getting Mohammed al-Baradei removed as Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. That's going on right now. Maybe even this weekend will get resolved. Next thing is Bolton's confirmation hearings. Whether or not he is or is not approved to be ambassador to the United Nations. Then the next point is the review conference, non-proliferation review conference in New York next month. And then, as you point out, finally, basically by June, the Iranians have sort of given notice that if they haven't gotten some significant movement or agreements with the European Union, they're just going to, you know, write it off. They're going to resume their attempts to reprocess. I'm not reprocess. Well, that too, but to enrich uranium. And my guess is that they will then turn to China and Russia and say, okay, so much for the European Union. Now from now on, we're just going to deal with you. And Russia and China, particularly China, have already got large investments in the oil and gas fields of Iran, and both countries also are providing them components for their nuclear fuel cycle program, for their peaceful use of nuclear weapons, nuclear energy. Okay, so back to what you just said, the golden offer. What al-Baradei has proposed, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, has proposed at various meetings and will probably again at the IAEA, the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference next month, he will probably again address them and propose the internationalization of such things as uranium enrichment. Now, that basically already has occurred in part because most of the enriched uranium, or the largest section of largest portion of enriched uranium, now comes from Urenco, which is a Netherlands, Brit, and German consortium. So there's already this example of, and in the case of the United States, we privatized the enrichment of uranium is a private sector entity, which
so America's basically has America tried to thwart the the agreement of the Europeans to this golden offer? Because it sounds like we'd be out of an excuse to attack them if the French and the Germans were running the reactors. Real quick.
Well, my own view is that if the Europeans can resist U.S. pressure, and it is intense, they may very well come up with some kind of agreement that says, okay, not only will you assist you Iranians enrich uranium.
Oh, sorry, that's it. Thanks, Gordon. Antiwar.com, everybody. Gordon Prather, thanks.